minutes, if I'm lucky. I fall into his chair and my insides thrum, my heart beating on overdrive. I tell myself I'm doing nothing wrong, that popping onto the internet is not a crime. The Reverend is a kind, accommodating man. If I'd asked him for a few minutes to check the news from home, I'm almost certain he would have said yes. I jiggle the mouse, type in the Reverend's password, and the lock screen dissolves into a crisp image of the Church of Christ's Apostles taken from above by a helicopter, maybe, or a drone. At its tallest peak, a golden cross gleaming in a cloudless blue sky. I listen for the sound of people in the hall, footsteps, the clattering of keyboards, voices calling out or talking into a phone. Someone sneezes, but otherwise it's quiet. Like everyone disappeared for lunch. I pull up the internet and type in the words that have been playing all day in my head on repeat. Sabine Hardison, missing. I'm rewarded with thousands of hits, and I suppose I shouldn't be surprised. News travels fastest over the internet. If the story is bled across state lines, if it's spread far enough to become a national news item on a major television network, then of course there's plenty more online. CNN, Fox News, all the major networks have picked up on the story. I scroll through the links, and a familiar title catches my eye. Mandy in the Morning. A taped episode promising dirt from Sabine's sister and a lover. As usual, Mandy doesn't mind speculating, and like the promos for her shows, the title on this one is complete clickbait. People in Pine Bluff love her, but I've never been a fan. I click instead on a link to the Pine Bluff Commercial, the local hometown newspaper. The article's title, Police Search for Clues in Case of Missing Pine Bluff Woman, swims on the page. A wave of nausea pushes up from the deepest part of me, and I breathe slow and steady and wait for the sensation to pass. I surf around a little more, casting panicked glances at the empty doorway. As far as I can tell, the news sites are all reporting the same meager facts. Last seen on Wednesday, car abandoned and unharmed. No clues. Zero evidence or leads. After a few more articles, I realize I'm getting nowhere, learning nothing new. I need to go straight to the source. With shaking fingers, I type in the address for Facebook, and the Reverend's personal wall fills the screen. Inspirational Bible memes, pictures of food and vacation snapshots, an ad for an expensive pair of running shoes. I lean back in his chair, chewing at a thumbnail that reeks of bleach, chastising myself for prying into his private business. Maybe I should sign out of his profile, create a new fake one for Beth. But I shove the idea aside as soon as I think of it. I don't know the Reverend's Facebook password, which means there's no way I could sign him back in. No, better to leave the computer just like I found it, and with no trace I've been here. I am so going to hell for this, I whisper. On the Reverend's Facebook profile, I pull up the page for the Pine Bluff Police Department. Pinned to the top, a call for information pertaining to Sabine's disappearance. Another reference to the tip line. I scan the post, but it tells me nothing new. If the police have any evidence or leads, they're not revealing them here. I scroll farther down the page, past staff announcements and PSAs for the dangers of texting while driving, then pause on a post at the bottom of the page. Another call for information about Sabine, alongside a photograph and four little words bursting like a bomb across my brain. Missing woman feared dead. Movement sounds in the hall, footsteps, and a door banging against a wall, and the Reverend's voice calls out, Charlene, get Father Pete at Christ the King on the line for me, will you? I'll be at my desk. Shit. I fumble for the mouse and back frantically out of the site, closing down Explorer, and returning to the desktop image of the church. The footsteps are moving closer, closer still, and I glance at the bookshelves, still full and unchanged, and realize I need a reasonable cover. I double-click the icon for Microsoft Word, and underneath the desk, the computer churns and whirs. Shit! I spring up from the chair, pluck a spray bottle and rag from the bucket, and give the desk a dousing right as the Reverend walks in.
You make any progress?
He says, glancing around at an office that is just as he left it. The bookshelves still stuffed with books, the printer still quiet. The answer, I'm thinking, is obvious. I point at the screen with the bottle. I think your computer's stuck. It's been trying to open Word since you left, and... Oh, look, there it is. It's working now. His smile bubbles up something unpleasant in my belly.
Good. But can I ask you to start on the shelves so I can get behind my desk? I'm expecting a call any second now, and I need a file on my computer.
Just then, right on cue, his desk phone rings. With one last flourish of the rag, I step away from the desk. All yours. He sinks into his chair, and I move to the shelves, my heart banging in my chest like a war drum. I stare at the books and pretend to come up with a plan, trying not to eavesdrop on his conversation. Something about a joint day of service at a downtown soup kitchen. I concentrate on the sound of his voice, the way it rises and falls when he talks, so I don't have to think about my guilt for betraying his trust.
I've still got the notes from last year somewhere, he says,
as I'm emptying the first shelf, piling the books in neat but lopsided stacks across the floor.
I'll dig them up and send them to you. Just give me a minute.
Behind me, his fingers click across the keyboard, and that's when it occurs to me. I didn't clear the browser history.
Marcus. The Pine Bluff PD's computer forensics unit is crammed in the lower back end of the building, in a windowless room that could do double duty as a broom closet. Jade, the unit's sole employee, can barely move around the computers and monitors, and the giant industrial-strength air conditioner, shoved in one corner, blowing icy air over the overheated electronics. If Jade minds the cramped quarters or the frigid temps, she doesn't complain. This job is a million times better than prison, which is where she was headed after she hacked her way into a national security program run out of Little Rock. I wrap a knuckle on the doorframe, and Jade swivels in her chair. Move some shit around and have a seat, she says, gesturing to a chair piled 3 feet high with files and unopened mail and a ratty pair of rain boots covered in mud. I'm almost done here. Jade's dishwater hair is shoved into a neat ponytail I've never seen her go without, her bangs hanging in frizzy chunks over glasses that were purchased last century. She's wearing her usual uniform, a holdover from the 80s, mom jeans, an oversized sweater, and giant neon earrings made of plastic. If I stopped her on the street, I'd think she was a schoolteacher, or maybe a librarian, until she said something. She has the mouth of a sailor and the speech patterns of someone half her age. I dump the junk on the floor and pull the chair closer to the desk. 6 monitors are stacked up the wall on the other side of Jade's head, and I try to make sense of what I'm seeing. Long lines of computer code crawling across the screens. Jade called me down here with promises of news of Jeffrey, but now that I'm here, I'm going to need a little additional help. What the hell is all this? Magic, Jade says, tapping the enter key. Somewhere under her desk, a printer whirs to life. She spins around, and her lips, coated in an unflattering coral, widen into a smile. Okay, so first of all, we totally lucked out that Jeffrey's cell phone account is with Verizon. Compared to all the others, they're a breeze to get into. Legally, I assume. Well, duh. Arkansas, remember? No warrant necessary, especially once the folks at Verizon heard Sabine's name. They didn't push back, not even a little bit. There's a but coming. I wait. Before you get too jazzed, I want to warn you that geographic location isn't always 100% accurate. Like, if we see your guy in a strip mall, for example, we won't know if he's in the coffee shop on one end or the dollar store on the other, or maybe even in the apartment complex next door. I think about the scenario Jeffrey stitched together for the afternoon his wife disappeared. Lunch at an Italian restaurant in Little Rock, followed by an hour, maybe more, of alone time on the river. I don't need Jade's pings to be exact, only close enough to verify he was where he said he was. Or not, and I'm betting on not. Jeffrey doesn't strike me as the introspective type. $100 says he was somewhere else entirely. How close can you get? Jade shrugs. Depends on the phone. Not all GPS chips are created equal, if you know what I mean. But even with an older model phone with a crappy chip, if your guy was, say, reading a book on a park bench by the river, we might get a ping that makes it look like he was standing knee-deep in the water. But at least we'd know he was where he said he was.
Was he?
She grins.
No, he was not.
That little shit. A familiar heat pulses in my chest, and my hands tighten into fists. This case might turn out to be a hell of a lot easier than I thought it would be.
Are you familiar with microcells?
She asks, and I shake my head.
A microcell is a little box the cell phone companies install in order to augment service in busy places. Places like parking garages and shopping malls and office high-rises. Think of it like a mini cellular tower inside a building where you otherwise wouldn't have the best reception. Microcells record highly precise location data. As long as your phone is on, I can see where you are, down sometimes to a few feet.
Are you saying what I think you are?
I don't know. Do you think I'm suggesting he was in a building with a microcell?
She gives me a saucy smile.
Because he was.
I want to reach across the desk, grab her by the ears, and plant one on her. That two-hour hole in Jeffrey's day? History. She whips a paper from the printer, slaps it to the desk, and flips it around so I can see. A map of Little Rock, covered in timestamps. She taps a finger to one, smack in the middle of the airport.
I started at 12 o'clock, right before his plane landed in Little Rock, and tracked him until 6 p.m., 2 hours after the neighbor said she spotted him pulling into his driveway in Pine Bluff. The timestamps on this map are every 10 minutes, but if you need me to narrow the time gap, I can do that. It'll just take me a few minutes to print you a new one.
Walk me through this one first, and then I'll decide. I scan the paper, taking in the timestamps. Looks like he was at the airport until 12:45.
Correct. 12:48 p.m. to be precise. He gets into a car, then heads west on 440 to 30 North. Just over the river, he takes exit 141B.
She taps the spot with a short clipped nail. The next ping is a block away. I squint at the letters on the page. What's on Olive Street?
Vinny's Little Italy. This isn't the microcell yet, by the way. These are all pings from a cell tower.
I nod, studying the map. So lunch at an Italian restaurant, at least, was true. Vinny's must be a pretty special place, seeing as he went all the way across the river. That's what, 20 minutes out of the way?
Something like that, but it's a dive. A 76 on the latest health inspection, which is basically like putting your life into their hands. A one-way ticket to a 24-hour puke fest. He was there until just before 2.
Don't tell me that's where he went next, clutching a toilet all that time.
Possible.
She locates the 2 p.m. dot on the map, then follows the ping south, back across the river, then due west. At 2:10 p.m., he veers off another exit, heading north on University Avenue. Her finger stops at another cluster of timestamps, all within a square block. What's this? I say, looking up. Why are these dots so spread out?
Bigger building. That whole block is CHI St. Vincent, a hospital with a microcell. He walks through the doors at 2:23 and heads to the southwest corner of the building. This is where things get dicey. The hospital is 10 stories, including the basement. I can see where he is, but not which floor. I had to do a bit of sleuthing.
Again, legal sleuthing? She rolls her eyes.
Do you want to know where he was or not?
Just tell me.
I held the pings up against the building plans and then used process of elimination. 4 stories I could cross off right away. Supply closets, bathrooms, the morgue. I crossed off the floors with patient rooms next. The rooms are too small, and the timestamps would have meant he was moving through the walls. It had to be a larger space, and there was only one floor that had one big enough, the second. Suite 203, specifically.
Which is?
The urology unit, a Dr. Patrick R. Lee.
And you know this for sure?
100%.
Jade pauses, and she chews her bottom lip.
But maybe don't tell anybody I said that. Maybe just take my word for it.
I puff a laugh. You hacked into the cameras, didn't you? She doesn't respond, and I take her silence as a yes. To tell the truth, I could give a shit how she got the information. The point is, Jeffrey has an alibi, and it's not food poisoning, but a problem with his plumbing. So why lie? He had to know I'd track down the truth eventually, and didn't he stop to consider that every minute I've spent chasing him down the rabbit hole of this reading by the river bullshit, I could have been out there looking for his wife? Have you checked his finances? Jade says, blowing back a chunk of bang. Could have used a hired gun. That's what I'm thinking. I'll take another look, but the accounts are mostly hers. Her salary is more than double his, and she squirreled a lot of it away. With her out of the picture, he'll be a very wealthy man. Even the house is in her name. Jade raises an eyebrow. Want me to keep digging? I could track his movements since Sabine went missing, see if there's anything out of the ordinary. There won't be. He's been careful, stuck close to home. What about his emails, texts, things like that? I'm going to forget you even suggested it since we don't have a warrant. Not yet, anyway. I drum my fingers on the desk, considering my next move. Actually, I do have something I'd like you to do, and that's keep a watch on the police department sites for me. The website, Facebook and Twitter pages, logins on the scanner, and whatever else we've got out there. I want to know about any strange hits. Define strange. Clusters of IPs coming from somewhere outside of Pine Bluff, most likely a city in the south. She gives me a skeptical look.
You think Sabine is on the run?
Maybe. Jeffrey said some things that made her seem like she might be unstable and...
Oh, come on! You don't believe that bullshit story he fed to Mandy in the morning, do you?
Not necessarily. But the sister confirms Sabine has tried to leave before, and I have reason to believe she had some medical issues that may have been in play here as well. I don't mention that last little tip came from Jeffrey and his carefully placed suggestion that Sabine might not have been pregnant. I found some old medical records on her laptop that indicate a string of failed pregnancies, along with correspondence with a local pharmacy about some prescriptions. All leads I'm still chasing down. I push up out of the chair. Just keep a watch on the sites, will you? Let me know if you see a bunch of hits coming from the same location. Call me the second you find something.
You got it.
Jade scribbles something on a sticky note, then turns back to the monitors.
Now, get out of here, will you? I got shit to do.
I slide the map from her desk and duck into the hall, my cell phone buzzing with a message from Charlie. I swipe and read the text, which is terse and to the point. Bingo. Charlie is a man of few words, but it's one I want to hear. I step into the stairwell and give him a call.
I found a bank account, he says by way of hello. Wells Fargo, opened a little over 3 years ago at a branch in Texarkana. Her first deposit was $1,000, which it looks like she made in cash. Since then, no more money flowing in.
My throat clenches in excitement, followed by a surge of something a lot less pleasant. $1,000 is a hell of a lot of cash, an amount that doesn't just go missing overnight, not without raising some red flags. An amount she would have had to have been squirreling away for months in order to not get noticed. And the withdrawals, I say from between clenched teeth, because for fucking sure there are withdrawals.
A 500 withdrawal last week, followed by withdrawals of 20 or 30 bucks a pop. And they're all over the place. North Platte, Nebraska, Lexington, Kentucky, Amarillo, Texas, Boise, Phoenix, Charlotte, Pittsburgh, Columbus.
She's trying to throw us off.
Sure looks that way, Charlie confirms. At this pace, she's got another 3.5 weeks before the account runs dry. You want me to keep following the transactions?
I drop my head and stare at the stairwell floor, grimy linoleum that looks like it hasn't been cleaned since the last century, and try not to scream. My pulse jumps, ticking away in my temples. Charlie can follow the transactions, but no way in hell it's her at the ATM machines. This is a ploy to throw me off, to send me scurrying down an opposite road in an opposite direction. Good thing I'm not that stupid. Keep an eye on the account, I tell Charlie. But don't get excited until there's a deposit, and then I want eyes on that camera footage. In the meantime, focus on what else she's got up her sleeve. Because there's more coming, that's for damn sure. Call me when you find it.
Roger that, he says,
and the line goes dead. I spend the rest of the day chasing leads. From a search of the prescription drug database, which the Arkansas Department of Health tells me I don't need a warrant for as long as I have a case number and probable cause, from Sabine's doctors, her general practitioner and OBGYN, neither of whom were as forthcoming. Both demanded a warrant before saying the first word. And from Dr. Lee, the urologist from Suite 203, where Jeffrey was pissing in a cup when 51 miles away, his wife walked out of a Super One and disappeared. Dr. Lee wouldn't tell me anything either. Which leaves me with Jeffrey. I pull to a stop at the curb and take in the stone and cedar siding, the neatly manicured lawn, the decorative woodwork around the dormers on the upstairs windows. What is this place? 4,000 square feet? Five? Even before Sabine went missing, it was more house than two people could ever need. Soon, this big fancy house and everything in it will be all his. I ring the bell, and his pleasant expression clouds over when he sees it's me. Good thing the reporters have packed up and gone. I hike a thumb over my shoulder in the general direction of the trampled grass at the edge of his lawn. Pine Bluff detective questions Jeffrey Hardison in broad daylight, news at 9. Talk to my attorney. He moves to shut the door, but he doesn't get far. I put out a foot, stop it with my boot. Riddle me this, I say, leaning against the door frame with a shoulder. Why would a guy give the detective investigating his wife's disappearance a bogus alibi when he already has an alibi, a real one that's easily verified? I just can't figure it out. Not unless he has something to hide. I catch a flash of oh shit pass over his face before he blinks it away. Are you always this cryptic, detective? He says, but his sarcasm falls a little flat. This would go a lot faster if you just say what you came here to say. Dr. Lee. Jeffrey pales at the name, and I know I hit the bullseye. I know you were at his office in Little Rock on the afternoon Sabine disappeared. How come? Got problems with the plumbing? A red flush rises up his face like a rash. That's none of your goddamn business. I can get a warrant, you know. Take a little look-see at your medical chart. A warrant is the only way you're going to get your hands on my records. And unless you happen to have one in your back pocket for this address, I suggest you move your foot from my doorway and back the hell off my porch. In fact, get the hell off my property. The or else hangs in the air between us like a bad smell. I inhale it long and slow, letting the silence stretch. The truth is, I don't care what his medical issue is, other than its ability to get him good and riled up. A cornered rat makes mistakes. There are a lot of ways to skin a cat. I step back, planting my soles at the edge of the porch. Just because you weren't there to wrap your hands around her neck doesn't mean you weren't the one to kill her. Who'd you pay? How much did you pay him to kill Sabine? His face is purple and shiny now, like an overripe plum. He slams the door in my face.
Beth. The work at Church of Christ's Apostles is hard, the hours long, mostly because this place is always bustling. A rolling program of worship services and holy get-togethers, Bible studies and prayer breakfasts and marital counseling and kids' clubs and childcare and we worship for kids 2 to 3. Reel the little punks in before they know their bait, you would say. And then there are all the people it takes to make this place run. The Reverend and his slew of church lady assistants, his pastors and ministry staff, an army of volunteers. And everywhere these people go, they leave traces of themselves. Fingerprints and shoe prints and keys that tumble from their pockets. We spend the day picking up and wiping away. But in the short time I've been here, the faces have become familiar. Their smiles as we pass in the hallways, more relaxed and instant. The Reverend was right. I am one of them now. The realization pushes a new worry up from the pile, that I will become too comfortable here, or maybe that I already am. When I walked through the doors, I was so scared, so worn down from running, that this place felt like something of a relief, a much-needed calm after the shit storm.
but already the relentless peacefulness of this place is getting to me, lulling me into a sense of security I can't afford. Now that Sabine's story has crept across state lines, now that it's stretched from a tiny Arkansas town to Georgia and beyond, I know what it means. It means you're closing in. The fear comes on strong and out of nowhere, and I sit back on my heels and swallow. Take a deep breath. Tell my heart to settle. I can't afford to be lazy because you are stealthy and cunning. I won't see you coming until you're already here. I drop my sponge in the bucket and whirl around, feeling ungrounded even though the carpet is grinding into my knees. Sleep has been hard to come by the last few nights, and my exhaustion is doing a number on my head. Too much up there to sort through. I can't get a grip on any one solid thought. There's nobody here. I'm alone. The Reverend's office is an oasis of quiet. I spend all day up here now, ever since Oscar called to say he was staying in Florida, and the Reverend gave me his job. Martina rolls her eyes whenever he brags about the brilliant job I did with his bookshelves, the way I grouped the books by subject, alphabetized them by author, and created a checkout system that any idiot can monitor. She thinks there's something else going on, some other reason he's taken me under his wing. And I don't disagree. Maybe it was my tears that first day, or my internet search history on his computer. Maybe he feels protective and wants to keep me close. Or maybe he's suspicious. I don't know. I study his face for clues when he thinks I'm not looking. But I can't find anything but kindness. Martina accused me of abandoning her, and she's not wrong about that either. Without me running interference between her and Ayana, the two in the same room are like a pressure cooker. The tiff I witnessed that first day only scratched the surface of the animosity between them, and 8 hours of scrubbing the same floors each day has not improved the situation. I try to stay out of it, but Martina is like a middle schooler, badgering me to choose a side on the car rides to and from Morgan House. "Yours," I told her just this morning behind the wheel of the Buick. "Of course I'm on your side." And I am, mostly. Probably. Even though we haven't had any heart-to-hearts, she still feels like someone who has my back. The least I can do is return the favor. So now I spend my days much like Oscar did, wiping down desks that are already spotless, and shooting the shit with Charlene and the 6 other church ladies in the offices lining the hall. I haul drinks and snacks to staff meetings and the late-afternoon huddle in the kitchen. I empty their trash cans and pick up the bits of paper that flutter from their pockets. The women are a chatty bunch, and in the dull patches of the day when they're not blabbing into their phones or clacking away at their keyboards, their questions come like gunfire. "Where are you from?" "Out west." "Are you single?" "Very." "What brings you to Atlanta?" "It seemed like a nice place to settle." I don't detect any agenda to their questions other than curiosity. But I always shift the conversation back to one of them. I'd much rather hear some long-winded discussion about a sister's money troubles or how to choose the right private school for the twin 4-year-olds. I feign shock when they tell me that Atlanta's public schools are not godly places, nor are the people who let their children go there. I shake my head in dismay when they say the standardized test scores from the students who attend public school are barely high enough to squeak out an acceptance letter to DeVry. What I don't do is bring up Martina's half-brother at Grady High, or tell them that even if he has the grades to get into private school, he probably couldn't afford it anyway. But I'm not fooled by their friendly get-to-know-you inquiries and water-cooler conversations. When lunchtime rolls around, they hook their bags over an arm and file out the door, arguing about whose turn it is to drive or whether they want salads or sandwiches. But not one of them ever thinks to ask me to join. There's still a hierarchy to this place, and I'm still the maid. Or maybe they wonder if I'm not who I claim to be.
It's Thursday afternoon, and I'm standing in the doorway of the Reverend's office, looking for something to clean. I've scrubbed all the floorboards and organized his desk, color-coded the file cabinets and polished all the picture frames, unknotted every paper clip, and thrown away every empty pen. How did Oscar do this job? Unlike him, I was not made to piddle the day away, scrubbing at spots that are already spotless. I need somebody to turn a briefcase upside down, or dump a full pot of coffee onto the Reverend's carpet. Until something falls or spills, there's nothing left to do. A commotion comes from behind me, from somewhere down the hall. Hurried footsteps and voices talking all at once, frantic words tumbling over each other in urgency, in alarm. One word sticks to the air like glue. Money. I turn and collide into a cluster of church ladies, a knot of panicked women gathered around a pink-faced Charlene. I take in her wide, worried eyes, the two red spots that glow on the apples of her cheeks like a rash.
"Where's the Reverend?"
she says, her voice breathy and taut.
"I need to speak to the Reverend this instant."
"He had a meeting, but he should be back any minute. What's wrong? What happened?"
"It's gone,"
she wails.
"The collection money is gone."
"Are you sure?" one of the church ladies says. "Maybe you just misplaced it."
"Well, of course I didn't misplace it."
Charlene punches a fist into her bony hip.
"It was there in my top desk drawer, and now it's gone. Somebody took it. Somebody stole it."
The words fall into the hallway like a dirty bomb, and two things flash through my mind at once. First, that I've never seen the normally perfect Charlene like this, all wild hair and smeared lipstick, not even when two birds flew into the chapel and began dive-bombing the women's Bible study group. Charlene had calmly fetched a couple of oven mitts from the kitchen, plucked the birds out of the air, and released them outside without ruffling a feather, theirs or hers. And second, that I'm surprised it took this long. What kind of idiot keeps a wad of cash in their desk drawer? Even in a church, even surrounded by all these godly people, it was only a matter of time before somebody swiped it. There were thieves in the Bible, too. The ladies gathered around Charlene clutch at their pearls. They may hold titles more impressive than Charlene's: head of youth programming, volunteer coordinator, manager of a whole squad of counselors. But Charlene runs this place. When she says the money was stolen from her desk drawer, the money was stolen. Maybe whoever took it, I don't know, moved it to a safer location. Like a bank, I think, but don't say. Behind them at the other end of the hall, the Reverend steps through the double doors. He's wearing a suit today, and a paisley tie so tightly knotted I wonder how he can breathe. He waves at me, cordial and cheerful as ever. And I hate what this is going to do to him.
"My desk drawer is perfectly safe,"
Charlene says to me. Her back is to the Reverend, so she hasn't seen him yet. Doesn't know he's sped up at the cluster of church ladies.
"It's locked, and only two people have a key, me and the Reverend."
"What about me?" he says, and the church ladies suck in a breath. Any other day, any other situation, I would laugh at how their eyes go wide, how they pivot to him as one. He takes in their expressions, and his friendly grin disappears.
"Good gracious, what's wrong?"
Charlene fills him in on the missing money. The more agitated she becomes, the more the Reverend remains calm. He cups his chin in a hand and listens.
"How much are we talking about?"
he says when she's done. Charlene turns a pale shade of green, grimacing like she might throw up.
"Somewhere around $2,000, a little more."
The Reverend takes it like a champ, barely even wincing.
"Okay, well, that's a lot of money, isn't it? When is the last time you saw it?"
Charlene presses a finger to her lips and thinks for a moment.
"Well, I added Monday night's collection money to the bag this morning, along with the 220s you borrowed from petty cash. The bag was still in there, closed and zipped, when I checked after lunch. But I didn't look inside. I just assumed. But just now, when I went to get it ready for the bank deposit, it was all gone. The bag was empty.
So, if I'm understanding you correctly, the Reverend says, the last time you know for sure the money was still there was this morning. Is that right?
Well, yes, when I added in the 20s.
And you're sure you locked the drawer afterward?
I always lock the drawer. It's as much a habit as brushing my teeth in the morning. I don't even think about it. I just do it. There's no way I would have forgotten.
Charlene's answer is immediate, but her tone doesn't sound all that certain. The Reverend turns to me. Is Charlene's key still in my desk drawer?
I
glance at Charlene, who's crying for real now, and shrug.
There are a lot of keys in your desk drawer. Which one is it?
The blue one, on a ring with a plastic running shoe and a pom-pom. Nike, I believe.
Then yes, I was at your desk just this morning. I saw it.
Charlene flashes me a frown.
What now?
She says to the Reverend.
Shouldn't we call the police?
At the last word, my heart stutters, and the skin of my face goes hot. If the Reverend says yes, I will be in my car before he can even pick up the phone. The instant his chin even dips in the direction of a nod, I'm out the door. What? You thought leaving me would be easy.
Your voice whispers in my ear.
You're not just running from me. You're running from the police now, too. How far do you think you'll get now that everyone is hunting for you? Who do you think will find you first? Them or me?
As much as I hate to admit it, you're right. If I run now, if anybody here decides I'm worth chasing down, one problem turns into two, and this becomes a whole different paradigm. And what about the money belt strapped to my waist? What would they think if they found it? What would the Reverend think?
I wait for his response, and a trickle of sweat runs down my back. People do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy his hunger when he is starving. Proverbs, chapter 6, verse 30. Let us assume that whoever took that money has a hungry soul.
Charlene nods, then frowns. You're just going to let them keep it?
Not exactly. What I'd like to do is for you to stay away from your desk for the next day or two and leave the top drawer open. That'll give the thief time to rethink his or her actions and opportunity to return the money where they found it. If the money is back in the envelope by close of business tomorrow, we'll forget this ever happened.
But what if it's not?
Charlene says, the question on everybody's tongue.
What if they don't put back the money?
The Reverend looks around at the people gathered in the hall, his gaze pausing on each woman's eyes. When he gets to mine, my heart explodes. Let's just pray that they do.
Marcus. Dr. Trevor McAdams lives in one of those houses on Country Club Lane that's trying too hard. Four sides of brick crawling with ivy. Sprawling rooms, topped with slate roof tiles. A view of the golf course, where men in prissy shorts whack balls and slap each other on the shoulder as they discuss where to outsource Pine Bluff's jobs next, Mexico or Asia. At least they'll never be able to outsource mine. The more this city gets steered into the gutter, the more bad guys there are for me to catch. Not that Trevor McAdams is a bad guy. As far as I can tell, he's only a heartsick puppy mooning over his missing lover. If those tears are an act, then give the man a golden statue. I ring the doorbell, one of those sleek high-tech devices with a camera picking up every pore on my skin. Inside, a dog goes ballistic. Along with Sabine's sister, Trevor has grabbed hold of the search for Sabine like a single-minded pit bull, transforming the story into a primetime media shit show. It's got all the right ingredients for tabloid fare. A local heroine who's young, attractive, and moneyed. A handsome lover pitted against a brooding and unpopular husband. Enough mystery to fuel a Twitter following of amateur detectives, all of them chatty and opinionated, filling his social media feeds with a million unanswered questions. The blood-sucking, schadenfreude-loving people of America are captivated. But I don't like it, and neither does my boss. The chief thinks the constant media attention is fucking with the investigation, and I don't disagree. Before Sabine went missing, the Pine Bluff police force was already overworked and understaffed. Her case is not the only thing on my plate. I've got better things to do than pander to the press. The door opens, and there he is, our story's hero. Though standing here in rumpled scrubs and bare feet, he doesn't look the part. He looks dingy, like he hasn't slept in days. Hasn't showered, either. His face is pale and thick with scruff, and his hair is flat, stuck to his head in greasy clumps. "Good morning, Detective. Please come in." He gestures with his arm that's not holding the dog, a white, fluffy thing baring its fangs. I step inside. "Thanks for seeing me. I know you're very busy." He shuts the door, then puts the dog down, and it scurries off into a bright modern kitchen overlooking the seventh green. Remainders of breakfast are spread across the granite countertops. A loaf of bread, a half-empty package of eggs, butter, and two types of organic jam. The doctor pulls a couple of glasses from the cabinet and pours from a giant jug of orange juice. "Can I offer you something to drink?" "No, thanks. This shouldn't take long." "Please tell me you're here to share some news." "I've got some news to share, but not the news you're hoping for, unfortunately."
"It's been 8 days, Detective."
"Like I don't know that. The doctor has only been phoning me daily, halting my work to hound me for information. Have you put a trace on her phone? Have you dusted for prints? Have you questioned her clients, her colleagues? What does he think? That I'm new at this? That I'm incompetent? Of course I've traced and dusted and questioned. This isn't the movies, and I'm not some dumbass small-town cop." He picks up the glasses and motions for me to follow. We pause at the door to the den, a room along the back of the house with a flat screen as big as the wall. Two kids are parked on an overstuffed leather couch, a boy and a girl with the doctor's face, two miniature doll-eyed yuppies. He settles the drinks on the coffee table.
"Guys, I'm going to be out in the sunroom talking to the detective. I need you both to stay here until we're done, okay?"
The kids nod in unison. The boy returns his attention to the television screen, but the girl's gaze sticks to me, wandering down my frame, zeroing in on my holster. Her eyes go wide, and she sinks deeper into the cushions. Great. The doctor is one of those parents, teaching their kids to be scared, not respectful of guns. We end up on a screened porch where the sun beats down on the slate roof and turns the room into a furnace. The doctor digs through a giant clam filled with remotes until he finds the one he's looking for, then points it at the wicker fan above our heads. From out on the green comes an occasional whop of metal whacking a ball.
"Sorry about the heat, but this is the only room the kids can't sneak into and hear us. They're having a really tough time with this. The separation, I mean. I'm sure you've heard that their mother and I are divorcing. She wants to move them to Salt Lake City where her parents live. Things are about to get ugly."
"I'm sorry to hear that." The fan stirs the air, sending down a breeze that feels like Emma's hairdryer after she's just come out of the shower, hot and humid. Already a steady line of sweat is dripping down my back. "Your daughter looks a lot like my niece, Annabelle. Well, like she used to look before the chemo. Her hair grew back in red and curly." He nods, sinking into the chair across from me.
"It's called chemo curls. The color change isn't uncommon either, though I don't think I've ever heard of it coming back red. But hair often picks up pigment as it grows back in, so I suppose it's possible. Who's your doc?"
"Annie Capelluto."
"Annie's the best in town, but Pine Bluff isn't exactly the center of the medical universe, you know. If your niece ever needs anything, give me a call. I did my residency at Northwestern and still have some pull there. Chicago's not all that far."
And that right there is the problem with outsiders like Dr. McAdams. People who swoop into town with their money and their fancy degrees, acting like the people of Pine Bluff, should be grateful they've come to this podunk town. I never asked for his help. Dr. Capiluto already saved Annabelle once. Who's to say she can't do it again if the worst happens and the cancer returns? He swipes his palms down his thighs. I'll move to Salt Lake City if I have to, but not yet. I can't leave this place, not until you find Sabine. He makes a sound, somewhere between a cough and a sob. I search for a fresh page in my notebook, giving him a moment to pull himself together. What about Jeffrey? He spits the name, his voice hard and hateful. What about him? Please tell me he's your lead suspect. He's violent and he's angry and he's got a 2-hour gap in his day at the exact time Sabine went missing. I told her to change the locks and take out a restraining order, but she wouldn't listen. She was scared of him. You know that, right? We're looking into Mr. Hardison, but I'm afraid I can't discuss the details. What I'd really like to talk with you about is you and Sabine. This is what I meant when I said he's a pit bull. It's like I didn't even speak. Excitement is piling up Trevor's words, and he barely pauses to take a breath. And it's just all too convenient. Sabine disappears right before she can file for divorce. Now he's living in her house, spending her money. Have you checked his email, searched the files on his computer? Have you looked into his internet history? I mean, I know it's cliche, but maybe he forgot to clear out his cash. You read all the time about how some idiot gets caught because they use Google to help them figure out the best place to bury a... He swallows the last word, and his face crumples. Is that what happened here? If it is, just tell me, Detective. For God's sake, put me out of my misery. Because I'm trying to be hopeful, but people simply don't disappear into thin air and show up 8 days later alive and well. I mean, somebody must have seen something, right? If that person exists, they haven't stepped forward. A tear nosedives into the scruff on his cheek, and he drops his head in his hands, shoulders quaking. I should have known this would happen. It's the same stunt he pulls every time a reporter points a camera at his face, blubbering for all the world to see. If he's faking it, he's a natural, I'll give him that. Sabine's disappearance has made national news, mostly thanks to this guy's bawling. Did you know Sabine was on Lexapro? The doctor's head pops up, and his expression is almost comical. Bugged eyes, unhinged jaw. Lexapro is an SSRI, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, a very potent one. It's used to treat anxiety and depression. Since when? Who prescribed it? I'm afraid I can't tell you the details, but according to the prescription drug monitoring program, she took it for years. Okay. Trevor says it without conviction, like he's bracing for what comes next. Like he suspects the prescription is not the only thing I'm about to drop on him. But Sabine wasn't depressed. I would have known. And I was with her a lot of the time. I never saw her taking any pills. She went off it last year. I flip back a page or two in my notes. In February, she was pregnant and she was worried it would hurt the baby. The doctor nods. It's a valid worry. SSRIs have been associated with increased risk for persistent pulmonary hypertension of the newborn. Her doctor would have helped wean her off it, and probably would have switched her to some kind of bupropion like Wellbutrin. That might be so, but she didn't run it by her doctor. The pharmacy filled it, then reached out to her when she didn't pick it up. This part, at least, is true, at least according to the email correspondence I found on her laptop. The pharmacist warned her about going off it too quickly. But the doctor in him picks up on my point and his eyebrows shoot up. Please don't tell me she quit cold turkey. She quit cold turkey. Initially, when I'd gleaned this from the emails on Sabine's laptop, I didn't understand the implications, but the doctor does. He jumps up from the chair with a curse, pacing the length of the room. And nobody told her what to expect? Nobody told her to, I don't know, maybe check WebMD before deciding to go off her meds? She could have died. I don't respond. There's a reason the FDA requires warning labels on drugs like Lexapro, because of too many links between the pills and people like Sabine slitting their wrists in a bathtub. But again, the doctor knows this. He stops pacing, turning to me with a frown.
Why are you telling me this? What does this have to do with whatever happened to Sabine?
I don't know yet. Maybe nothing. Maybe everything.
It sounds to me like you're blaming the victim, trying to make it seem like she was unhinged, unstable.
I'm just trying to get a clear and complete picture of Sabine.
Does this have something to do with the bullshit Jeffrey was spouting off to Mandy in the morning? Because Ingrid told me what happened back then. Sabine was leaving him, but she wasn't running away. Ingrid knew where she was the whole time.
Yes, she told me the same. Twice, actually. First in a voicemail after Mandy's show, then again when she stopped by the station. The doctor's eyes go squinty.
Why do you say it like that?
Like what?
Like you don't believe her. Like you think Sabine might have been a little unstable.
We just determined that she was on Lexapro. I might as well have slugged him in the gut. His shoulders hunch, and he falls back into his chair.
So she was going through a rough time. She lost her baby, got some shitty medical advice, or maybe none at all. But that was a long time ago, and the Sabine I know is not depressed. She doesn't have mood swings. Her energy is normal, and so are her sleep patterns. The only symptom I've seen started a couple weeks ago.
His eyes tear up all over again, and I know he's referring to her pregnancy. I'm glad you brought that up, because...
But the nausea never lasts long. She vomits, and then 10 minutes later, she's digging through the pantry for food. Not like when...
He stops himself, grimacing, and I know he was about to compare his lover's pregnancy to his wife's.
The point is, Sabine's appetite is fine.
You know for certain that Sabine is pregnant. I don't phrase it as a question, even though it is one. The same one I asked her general practitioner and the OBGYN who'd handled her last pregnancy. Both refused to give me an answer. The doctor looks properly insulted.
What? Of course Sabine is pregnant.
Did you conduct the pregnancy test yourself?
She peed on a stick. Those tests are 99% accurate, you know.
Did you see with your own eyes that the stick read positive?
What are you implying here?
He's getting riled up. His voice rises and his muscles tense, coiled for attack.
That Sabine lied? That she wasn't pregnant?
I keep my own voice low and even. I'm not implying anything. I'm just trying to dig up the truth.
By implying she wasn't pregnant?
According to her husband, Sabine had trouble both getting pregnant and staying that way. Over the course of their 9-year marriage, she lost some 7 pregnancies, and that's only after going through multiple rounds of IVF. Maybe the problem was with him, with his sperm. Or maybe she's had enough false starts to know how this pregnancy will end. If she's pregnant, chances are high that she'll miscarry, and if the past is any indication, somewhere between 10 and 14 weeks.
If she's pregnant, why would she lie about something like that?
That's what I'm trying to figure out. He leans forward, elbows on his knees.
Let me get this straight. You don't want to ask me about my relationship with Sabine, when it started, or what our plans are, or to talk about any one of the million messages Sabine and I exchanged over these past 5 months. Instead, you want to put doubts in my head as to her sanity and fertility. It's almost like you're trying to make me think that the woman I know and love is someone else entirely.
All I'm doing is trying to fill in some blanks. In order to find a person, I need to know who she was. He pales, his cheeks draining of blood.
Was?
Is, I say with all the conviction I can muster. It's a blunder I won't make again. I am working under the assumption that Sabine is still alive, but in order to find her, I need a complete picture.
You want a complete picture? Well then, here it is. Sabine Hardison is a kind, loving, funny, honest, loyal, caring woman, and I love her with everything inside of me. No, she didn't tell me about the Lexapro or the miscarriages, but that doesn't make her a liar. It makes her a human with a past.
Okay then, let's talk about your wife. His spine straightens.
Shelley? What about her?
I understand she's in Chicago. Since when?
Since last week.
He stops himself, shakes his head, grows an inch in his chair. He was about to say Wednesday, the day Sabine disappeared.
No, she wouldn't. She couldn't. Shelley may be hurt and angry, but she's not a monster. She is the mother of my children. No way.
Still,
I'd love to talk to her in person, hear her say those words to me herself. When is she back?
I don't know.
I've been leaving messages on her cell. Maybe you could give her a little nudge, ask her to call me back. He blasts me with a cold, sharp stare.
Look elsewhere, detective. My wife has been through enough.
My wife. I let the words linger in the steamy air long enough that the doctor looks sheepish. He's the possessive type, another strike against him. And if he thinks I'm going to overlook his wife just because he wants me to, he's crazy. The door behind him opens, and a gust of cooler air sweeps across my sweaty skin. Not enough, but still a relief, and for both of us. The doctor looks beyond grateful for the interruption.
Daddy, I'm hungry,
his daughter says, but she's looking at me. He stands and moves to the door, reaching for his daughter's hand, but his gaze never leaves mine.
Detective, what are you currently doing to find Sabine? What steps are you taking? What leads are you exploring?
I'm sorry, sir, but I can't discuss the details.
I know.
Fine. He picks up his daughter, hoisting her onto a hip in one smooth move.
How about instead of sitting here wasting my time with this baloney line of questioning, you get out there and find Sabine?
He stops there, but his words, his tone, they both carry the unmistakable weight of a threat. I hope you're not implying what I think you are. Did you just threaten an officer of the law?
Do your job, detective. Do your job, or else I will find someone who will.
Beth. For the rest of the day, all anyone can talk about is the missing money, where it is, when it went missing, whether or not it's going to magically reappear in Charlene's desk drawer before the deadline tomorrow. But mostly, which one of us took it? It doesn't take a genius to know I am the main suspect. Sure, people float in and out of the executive offices during the day, but I'm the only one besides the church ladies who's here all day long, from 8 a.m. until closing time, and the only one besides the Reverend with access to the keys in his drawer. They all look at me differently now. Their formerly friendly smiles have turned pinched around the edges, and they've closed ranks, stopped being so nice. They wouldn't put it past me. Everybody steers clear of Charlene's desk, presumably to give the thief, me, opportunity to repent her, my, sins, and return the money to the bag. But they haven't thought their strategy through. All afternoon they linger in the offices lining the hall, pretending to discuss church business while one of them keeps an eagle eye on the reception area. Anytime anybody comes within a 20-foot radius of Charlene's desk drawer, they drop the pretense and come running. It's probably the most excitement this place has seen in ages. Maybe ever. The news has spread through the church like a deadly virus, infecting the staff with a Hunger Games kind of fear, the sinking knowledge that one person will take us all down. I know because Martina has been texting me all afternoon, saying that things downstairs have turned ugly. The rest of the cleaning staff is pointing fingers, and their fingers all seem to be pointing to me.
They're convinced that you took it. Well, everybody but Ayana, but she's never been the brightest votive in the chapel. They want me to tell you to put it back before you get us all fired.
I try not to be hurt by their easy assumption of my guilt. I tell myself the only opinion I care about is Martina's. The others don't know me, don't know my situation or my thoughts, but the accusation still stings. And you? I type back. What do you think? Her answer lights up my screen.
IDK. I'm still trying to decide.
A thunk comes from the double doors, and a foot kicks one of them open. The Reverend shoulders his way through, carrying a cardboard box half his size, concealing his upper body, his face, all but the tips of his hair. But I know it's him from the shoes, the well-loved sneakers he changed into earlier under his navy suit pants. I slip my phone in my back pocket and rush to hold the door.
Oh, thank you, Beth,
he says, flashing me a smile around the side of the box.
That's very kind of you.
If the Reverend suspects me of anything, of whatever he saw or didn't see in his computer's history files, of swiping the cash from Charlene's drawer,
of not being who I claim to be. I can't detect it in the way he looks at me. It's the same way he looks at the men and women who stand before his altar when he pats their shoulders or folds his hands in prayer. Like I am a sheep to be saved. Which will make it all the more awkward when I sneak out the back door tomorrow afternoon, right before he makes good on his promise to call the cops. Jorge's good, but he's not that good. One look at my license and the cops will slap on the cuffs. But the Reverend is not stupid. He'll know the reason for my vanishing act, just like how everybody else in this place will be making their own assumptions. Guilty. And then what? I've heard those sermons the Reverend practices in his office, the ones about uncertainty and grace and turning the other cheek. Will he do the same with me? Will he let me go? Or will he dispatch the police to the address on file, the one I listed on my application? Stupid, stupid mistake. The one for Morgan House. And next week is payday. I picture my paycheck languishing in the bottom of Charlene's drawer like catnip. A whole week's worth of salary down the drain. I need that money, every cent. Come with me, will you? The Reverend asks. I'm putting together welcome bags for the newcomers, and I could use some help. I follow him down the hall into his office where he settles the cardboard box on the conference table. Printed papers and shiny, colorful brochures are spread across the table in neat stacks. He points them out one by one. Pastor's letter, church brochure, invitation cards to various clubs and groups, a Bible booklet, and a feedback form. What I need you to do is clip them together and drop them into an envelope. He pulls a pile of envelopes from the box and hands them to me. I smile. Sounds simple enough. Once you're done, the packets go into one of these. He drags a white canvas bag from the box and shakes it out for me to see. The logo is a variation of the one on my t-shirt, a sketch of the church skyline with "God Lives Here" underneath. Every tote also gets a coffee mug, personalized pen, and refrigerator magnet, all of which are in the box. If you run out of anything or need help, just give one of the office ladies a holler. I have to dash to visit a sick parishioner on the other side of town. While the Reverend gathers up his things, I sink onto a chair and get started. Pile, fold, clip, stuff. The work is slow and monotonous, but it beats scrubbing floors, and at least I can do it sitting down. I think of Martina and Diana downstairs, sterilizing toys and bonding over their shared distrust of me, and I wince. I'd hate me too if I were them. See you tomorrow, the Reverend says. I look up and he's standing at the door, his suit coat folded over an arm, his leather wingtips dangling from his fingers. He smiles, and it's all I can do to return it. See you tomorrow. I'm working my way through the piles when Martina sneaks into the Reverend's conference room without making a sound. I look up, and there she is, watching me from the doorway. I smile, but she doesn't return the greeting. I ignore the snub, working with the papers in my hand, fastening them with a paper clip. Don't tell me. They sent you up here to talk to me, didn't they? I picture the cleaning crew cornering her in the break room, demanding she march up here and do what? Confront me? Pat me down? I keep my eyes on the papers and Martina in my peripheral vision. She shuts the door behind her. Can you blame them? They have pretty much all done business with a guy like Jorge, if you know what I mean. They're nervous as hell, just like I am, just like you should be. I look up at her with a frown. Who says I'm not? And if you came up here to lecture or accuse me, you can go ahead and leave now. The church ladies have been giving me the side eye all afternoon, and I already feel shitty enough. This isn't some kind of game, Beth. I got you this job. I vouched for you. If the Reverend finds the $2,000 and that thing strapped to your waist, what do you think is going to happen to me? So you think I took it too? Great. I lift both hands, let them fall to the table with a smack. The church ladies had Bible study this morning.
So?
So the offices would have been empty? You would have had an opportunity. And we both know how you like to hoard money. Her eyes stray to my waistline. How much is in there anyway?
I push to a stand, make myself loose at the knees. One wrong move and I'll mow her down on my way to the door.
None of your business, that's how much. And what about you and Ayana? Y'all were up here too, bickering about which one of you was the bigger thief. I saw both of you go by Charlene's desk more than once.
Yeah, but we don't have access to the Reverend's keys.
She pauses, and I brace for what I know is coming next.
You do.
I shake my head to hide that I'm squirming inside. I'm not going to stand here and defend myself when I haven't done anything wrong, especially when it sure looks like you're the one who took Ayana's money. Well, did you?
Martina squints.
I already told you, I'm not a thief.
Then who took it?
She tosses up her hands.
Who the hell knows? There were always a million people going in and out of her apartment, and her hiding place wasn't exactly subtle. If I found it, others would have too.
I reach for a stack of envelopes and think about Martina's answer. Her tone is sincere, but that still doesn't explain why she was searching behind Ayana's toilet. Who goes looking for money they're not planning to steal? Martina sighs and slumps against the wall, looking around.
What is it you do up here all day, anyway?
Die of boredom, mostly.
Why does the Reverend want you up here? What made him ask you?
I don't know. The bookshelves, I guess, and you know how the Reverend is. He likes to take care of people. I think of my sudden tears that first day, the way he told me I was safe here. In the days since, he's certainly made good on that promise.
He's never taken care of me like that.
A question lingers in the air between us, but I don't touch it. Martina wants to know what makes me special, and to answer is to acknowledge she's right. The Reverend has singled me out, and for reasons I don't understand, and would rather not think about. Why me? Why not her? She pushes off the wall, stalking straight at me. Automatically, my hands move to the belt at my waist, my palms spread out, my fingers curling around the edges.
Tell me you didn't take the money, Beth. Look me in the eye and tell me it wasn't you.
I can't believe you're even asking me that.
Say it!
Panic flutters like a swarm of bats in my chest, but I park my expression in neutral.
I'll tell you if you tell me who Rosa and Stefan are.
The names, the ones written in complicated curly script on the silver discs hanging from her neck. Her face pales at the accidental bullseye. My heart kicks, then stops completely, as does my breathing. If she looks me in the eyes and answers me honestly, if she trusts me enough to tell me this truth, then I will do the same with her. I will sit her down and tell her mine, the whole sad, sordid story. She leans in so close that her features go out of focus.
Put it back, Beth! You're not the only one who's going to pay if you don't. Put the money back.
Marcus. There are a few dozen authorized cell phone retailers in Pine Bluff proper, wireless franchises like AT&T and Sprint, along with a couple of big box stores like Walmart. Places lawful people go when they're shopping for a cell phone, the kind that have customer service departments and surveillance cameras. And then there are the unauthorized outlets, repair shops and mini-marts where cell phones are bought and sold on the sly. I start there, on the north side of town, and work my way south. And every time, it goes a little something like this. Me, flashing badge. Detective Marcus Durand, Pine Bluff PD. I'm looking for a female, early 30s, brown hair and eyes, 5'8", slim build. Store manager. I'd love to help you, detective, but that's half the women who come in this place. Me, holding up a photograph.
I'm thinking you'd remember this one. Manager, whistling. She's pretty, all right. Me. She would have purchased multiple prepaid cell phones, and she would have paid in cash. The transaction would have been in the past month or so. Manager. Sorry, detective, we have dozens, 50, hundreds of transactions a day. It's impossible for me to remember every one. Me, slapping down a 50. How about you check your computer? If her transaction is in there, it won't take you that long to find it. It would have been bigger than usual, and all cash. Him, pocketing the 50 and slinking off to the back. Sometimes it takes him a couple of minutes to search, sometimes longer. But every time, when he returns from whatever back office he disappeared into, he's shaking his head, and every time, I leave the store empty-handed. Except for this time. This time, the manager walks out, grinning like a fool. May 24th, at 10:24 a.m., she bought four. Two new LG K8s and two refurbished Motorolas. Total, including tax and minutes, was $407.73. I breathe through the white-hot rage, waiting for the flames to cool, but the anger doesn't subside. $400 is a lot of money to have spent in a place like this one, a total dump. The kind of store that has a gun under the register and bars on the windows to tamp down on the drive-bys. The kind that trades stolen goods for stolen cash. I'm going to need the numbers, I say through clenched lips. My jaw is like a boulder, bearing down on my molars hard enough to crack them in two. The manager frowns, his face scrunching into a heinous mess. I just gave you the numbers. He looks at the paper in his hand, where he'd scribbled the basics in messy blue pen. Here, 407.73. The phone numbers. My hands curl into fists, my muscles vibrating with the force of holding them still. I want to punch this idiot in his ugly face for fucking with me, especially when he drops his hands in his pockets and leans back on his heels, squinting in a way that doesn't look the least bit thoughtful.